problem is I've already had the best part of my morning. So I'm sorry, it only gets downhill from here because that was fantastic. Jen, thank you. There's something poetically beautiful about a woman singing, "You've got to pay for what you get." There's like a whole genre of female songwriters, Dolly Parton being among them, who like has that "you're going to get what come into you" song. And
it's the same birthday, Dolly Parton.
Do you really? That's incredible. I love Dolly. So you're channeling a little bit of your inner Dolly from that. I love that. And Bob, that meditation. I mean, seriously, we can all just kind of say namaste or amen or whatever and just go from here. This is so good. So good. You know, this little series that we're in, I'm beginning to rethink it because we were kind of coming off of the year end, getting ready to kind of like chart a course for moving forward. But there's some things that needed to happen in between that. So we kind of, and by we, I picked this like kind of series around a set of ideas that I found intriguing. And what was supposed to be just kind of like, this will hold us over for 4 to 6 weeks is turning into this monumental thing in my head. And I'm like, how do I even begin to bring this back down to earth? Because this morning we're talking about the ego. And we're peeling back the layers of identity. And as I said the first week, if you can kind of think of this as Mrs. Frizzle, for those of you who are familiar with the Magic School Bus, we're kind of getting on the Magic School Bus, and we're kind of like zooming in, and we're looking metaphorically on our layers of identity. We're peeling back layer after layer. And somebody used the metaphor this morning. He's like, yeah, it's like peeling back layer and layer after onion. And then I said, yeah, and then you discover it's onion all the way through, you know. And that's the really tricky part about these conversations is there's no hard and fast delineations between these things, but that's the way our brain likes to make things work. So for a working definition of what we're working with here, we're calling the ego simply the sense of self or I that we carry through the world. It's how we construct our sense of self. It's a tool for navigating the world, for creating our sense of identity, helping us to relate to others, and giving us structure. We'll start here a little at the clinical level, but I don't want to stay here. We're not going to dive too deep into all these things. You can get all of this in countless books or philosophy classes. I'm a little more practically interested on what this sense of self means for us individually and how we create this sense of self for us. So the role of the ego mediates between our inner world, our thoughts, our desires, and our emotions, and our outer world, what we would call reality. We see this outer world as being separate from us, and us as a being that navigates through this world. And we create the sense of self as a way of navigating this reality. It helps us navigate our daily life. It helps us make decisions. Everything from what kind of shoes am I going to put on this morning, or how am I going to do my hair, to what am I wearing, what did that person say about me. Our sense of self is constantly being constructed from this narrative of external stimuli, these things that are coming into our world, and what our brain, our consciousness, chooses to do with that information. The ego is your current sense of self. The reason I say current is because our current sense of self is always in flux, isn't it? Even though we perceive ourselves as existing on the spectrum, we only have here and now. What we call the past is a collection of memories of things that happened to us that we file away up there. But that past is a hypothetical construct that we bring into the present when we're thinking about or talking about something that happened last week, last month, this morning. And then when we're talking about the future, we're again hypothesizing about events that may or may not happen. So we're only concerned with. We're only talking about this current sense of I that exists in what we would say the here and now, and that's all there is this present moment. So this ego is your current sense of self, and it's shaped by your experiences. It's an awareness of yourself as you are right now. If you feel pain, if you feel hunger, if you feel embarrassment when you meet somebody and you forget their name, that ego is the part of you that is embarrassed. Somebody is judging you based upon something you did or didn't remember, did or didn't do. It's your ego's way of interpreting those experiences. We use this camera metaphor, I think, in week one. We were talking about fast and slow thinking, and I don't want to, like, connect these two, but there's another camera illustration that is a helpful way to thinking about this, that the ego is the lens. It's essential for focusing on the world, but it's not the camera through which you see the world. So this lens is, as anybody knows who's a photographer, an essential part of what helps you craft a good composition, the quality of your lens, the quality of the glass. But it's not the camera. It's a way of seeing through the world. And our ego is this sense of self that we cultivate. It's this lens through which we see the world that we bring to bear on all our experiences, on everything that is said and done. It forms as we grow. It's shaped by our interactions with family, society, and culture. And here's something about it that is rather annoying, that our ego loves labels and categorization. Because as a human species, we at somewhere along the line in our evolution, our brains began to be really good at this process of categorization. It's what allowed us to supersede other species who were only interested in categorization for simple things, like, is this going to kill me? Should I eat this or not? But as a species and as a social species, we began to realize, in fact, that how I interact with Dick and how Dick interacts with me is helpful to our bond together, and it actually means that we can be stronger together. And we begin to form these bonds, and our brains found an opportunity to consume all this real estate, this mental real estate, around the question of how am I doing in this social sphere? The amount of mental real estate, the amount of thoughts, if we really stop and pay attention to our thoughts, that are concerned around labeling and judging things as good or bad, helpful or harming. Our brains have developed that into a superpower and a super curse. It is also our sense, or it is our one of our best tools for self-growth, but it can harm us more than anything else, because when we carry that sense of judging, of labeling into the world, it serves us to a point until we become slaves to that. And that's where we get, and we'll touch on the shadow side of the ego. We're not going to get into that deeply. Kent has talked a little bit about that if you want to look at some past talks. We're also going to invite, we've just lined up Michael DeWild, who's a ethicist that brings another perspective to this conversation. So I'm really interested in bringing him into this. Where are we going with this here? And this is kind of an odd place to sandwich this right in the middle of the talk. But let me just remind us here that these conversations, I feel, are helpful for us to take moments to be able to hold up a mirror to what we would call our sense of self. And I'm not here to convince you of anything. I'll probably share some things that would be opinions of mine as we get a little bit closer to landing the bus and discovering what we would say is our sense of self, that deepest sense. But I could be wrong, and there's plenty of conversations around that deeper sense of self. It's less helpful to try to answer the question than it is to be asking the questions and wrestling with that work of beginning to strip away the things that don't serve us and to allow our ego to be a tool to serve us and not a taskmaster that has the wheel. And these are connected to this value that we share of open inquiry, where the role for us as a community is not to say, here's where we believe on this, because we've all come from those kinds of places and those kinds of communities. It's in asking the questions that we begin to wrestle and we begin to learn and hopefully grow and improve what we would call the sense of self. So back to the shadow side here. Jung coined this term, and he described the shadow side as this unconscious part of our personality that contains repressed weakness, desires, and instincts, and it's the part of ourselves that we try to hide or reject. I think of it in the way that the shadow side contains elements of things that we've struggled to verbalize. That's why frequently we need good therapists to help ask the right questions to identify those things. We struggle to verbalize these parts of ourselves, but if we could, and if we're guided in the right way, we would identify these aspects as the things that if everybody knew this about me, they wouldn't love me. I would be excluded from the community, which is to our primate community bonded selves one of the most horrific ends: exclusion, loneliness, separation. It's why we work so hard to cultivate this ego, to communicate our connections with one another as a sense of safety and a sense of security moving through the world. But this shadow side comes when we find ego-driven behavior start to emerge. These things that come up out of nowhere, where we talked about this morning, these things where you say or do something, and afterwards, sometimes maybe even 30 seconds later, you're like, who was that? Why did I say that? I have probably at least two or three specific examples right now in my head that is really working on me, things where my words got ahead of my brain, or my shadow self had the reins and started speaking, and I said some things that as soon as they were said, I immediately, you know that feeling, like, oh my gosh, command Z, undo, bring it back. No, it's too late. And you say and do those things, and you know the harm and the damage it causes, and then you have to just simply say it's going to take time to try to mend that wound. Our shadow side can be rather devious. It's how the ego reacts to perceived threats. When the ego feels threatened, it generates these responses of defensiveness. This is a terrible one, comparison, and a fear of failure. And of course, we don't even need to spend any time talking about how our social media systems that so many of us now initially used as a form of connection have become tools to further isolate us and separate. So how do we work on allowing our ego to be less in control? Last night, I can give you an example of something that Lisa and I did. This one challenged me a little bit. We grew up, as you might know, in a Christian cult, so like things like dancing, not even in the equation, and we didn't even have a dance at our wedding. So here I am, all these years later, in a adult body having missed this essential connection with self that comes from dancing, part of the human experience. And some friends of ours hosted an event at a yoga studio in Holland called Ecstatic Dance. I don't know if you've heard of or ever seen anything like that. It's probably exactly as weird as you would think it would be from that description. But it was weirdly beautiful. And Lisa and I both joked as we were driving home, we were like, that was free therapy for us, because it really held up a mirror to my ego, that sense of self that is so concerned about what other people think. And we started getting in touch with our bodies and feeling our bodies and being present in the space, and then moving not in a way that looked good. If you would have filmed me, it did not look good. I don't have moves. I would like to say that this story ends with, I found my groove and I'm dancing. No, I did not. I looked weird and crazy, but there were plenty of other people who would look that way too, and it helped take my ego down a notch. It helped remind me that the sense of self that I so work so hard to try to curate, it's malleable, it's temporary. And this is where we start to get to the good part, I think, in where we're talking about the ego. These couple of quotes. The first one's from John O'Donohue, Irish writer of Anamkara, and he says that the ego is the false self. It's born out of fear and defensiveness. You see, the ego thrives on separation and on connecting our sense of identity as separate selves, creating a me versus you and an us versus them. That's why sociologically we know that even greater than our sense of community is this idea of self-preservation, and we, just like primate species, will try to protect our own in-group at the exclusion of others when provoked with fear or anger. And those incredibly volatile emotions are very useful tools to motivate people into perceiving themselves as separate from and other than, instead of seeing how much we are together. Michael Singer in Untethered Soul, quoting Yogananda, he said, Yogananda said, ego is the masquerading self. In other words, the facade that you have pulled over your consciousness to define yourself. It's a form of a mask. Within spiritual traditions, there's a lot of talk about the role of the ego, ego disillusion, ego separateness, and especially even within the psychedelic community, one form of connection, if you're a psychonaut and if you're trying to look at yourself, to hold up a mirror to yourself, is this idea of ego loss or ego dissolution. Richard Alpert and others talked about it in some of the early Harvard experiments. I can tell you, as someone who both has strove for that and attained it, it is both enlightening, enriching, and also scary as hell to realize that this cultivated sense of identity, this self that we carry through the world, is such a fragile shell. When I emerged from one experience that was especially profound for me, I had the encounter, the unique perspective of, for just a handful of minutes, forgetting my name and my sense of self and reconstructing that kind of in real time by going to the door. There was a package on the front step, and I remember picking up that package and looking at the label and seeing it was addressed to Brad Ruggles, and experiencing that brief moment of like, oh, that must be who I am. And it sounds and looks cool when Jason Bourne does it in the Bourne movies. It's a lot scarier when you're experiencing that yourself. That sense of free fall of not being able to latch on to anything that gives you that sense of identity, of connection. I don't think the goal really is in ego loss. I think there's some useful, helpful tools to do some work with the ego. But I would be more interested in ego integration than ego dissolution. In learning to identify the parts of ourselves that react, to identify the parts of ourselves that respond, the pieces of us that oftentimes require the most work, to identify, to become aware of them, to integrate them into our whole, but to recognize that they're a tool, they're a lens, they're not the camera. I would say that the ego's job isn't to be destroyed, it's to be integrated. Alan Watts, who I love, you know, and managed to insert something that he says in every talk, he, in his book, one of the first books that I loved from him is called simply The Book, : On the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Really Are. Some of you go way back may remember that book. It's got a rather provocative title, as a lot of those hippie works coming out of that integrated consciousness things. But from that book, he says, the most stunningly enforced, or the most strongly enforced of all known taboos, is the taboo against knowing who or what you really are behind the mask of your apparently separate, independent, and isolated ego. Who are you when you begin to pull back those layers? Because the ego can be useful when it's working within its proper role. It's helpful to know if our breath stinks, so that when we're talking to people, we're not bringing up repulsive, exclusive body language. That's a helpful tool for me to know. This is why we have friends who tell us if our fly is unzipped. I would trust all of you to be that friend to me. I have spoken on stage before and gone all the way through to the very end with an open fly, and I did not realize that. The funny thing is, for somebody who is obsessed at doing this kind of ego work, this is one of the most egocentric careers and jobs, is a communicator. It makes it rather difficult, and it's why it probably forces me to more extreme measures to do that inner work. But to be in front of people, to be constantly questioning the labels, the judgment, the questions. So we're not trying to remove the ego. We're trying to recognize and to be aware. Ram Dass says, the term ego is a structure of mind that organizes the universe, particularly around the relationship of separateness. It's the domain of separateness. It is the steering mechanism for you as a separate identity. In spiritual evolution, you don't destroy the ego. You merely turn away from identifying with it to having it as a functional unit. So we're asking the question as we get a little bit further along in the series, if the ego is the lens, who is behind the lens? If the ego is not the true self, we recognize it as a tool which we can use to interact with the world. When we let go of over-identifying with it, we can glimpse a deeper essence of who we are underneath the curated image. Who is observing the thoughts? Who is the watcher? Who is the one that is aware? Who is behind the lens? if we're more than our thoughts, our roles, and our feelings, is it possible that there's an awareness behind that that we can cultivate? I'll close with that same quote that I've said before from Ram Dass, reminding us that it's time for us to see through the absurdity of our own predicament, that we're just simply not that person that we thought we were. You're not that person, and in this very lifetime, you can know it. To do the work of transformation, of cultivating that interior landscape, creating the space and the silence so that we can pay attention to what emerges from the depths of ourselves. Thanks for being a part of this talk, for bearing with sometimes these rather lengthy deep dives into some conversations that some would prefer to just fast forward to the end. As we're close to landing the bus here in the next few weeks, we're by no means arriving at a particular place saying this is your final destination. But it allows for the conversations to be had, and it's important ones. So thank you for having them with me. Namaste.